Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Drop by any farmer's market in the Sacramento area and you will see the bounty. Honey from Yolo County, grapes from San Joaquin County, apples from El Dorado County, mandarins in Placer County, almonds and nuts from Stanislaus County, and cherries and pears from Sacramento County. We pretty much have it all right here in Northern California, specifically in the Sacramento and San Joaquin Valleys. But new data shows that while our area supplies the nation and the world with so much, we have a hard time feeding people in our own backyard. From supply chain issues to logistics, infrastructure problems, the pandemic exposed an already challenging situation and made it worse. Joining us to discuss her reporting is Sacramento Business Journal agriculture reporter Emily Hammond. She recently published an article on how the pandemic exacerbated food insecurity issues, despite being one of the leading food producing regions in the world. Emily, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Emily, despite the pandemic, local farmers, they kept growing their products to the tune of $1.3 billion in 2020. What are some of the main products that we grow here and where do they go?
So first of all, almonds are huge. California is the worldwide leader in almond production. The climate and the soil in the Central Valley is so perfect for growing almonds that it's basically one of the only places in the world that they can grow at a commercial scale. California produces 80% of the world's almonds, and Blue Diamond Growers, of course, headquartered right here in Sacramento, is the largest exporter of almonds in the world. We also grow a fair number of walnuts and pistachios, which we export a lot of as well. Wine grapes are also huge. When I say wine, you probably think of the Old Sugar Mill or El Dorado or Amador, but Sacramento County is the region's largest grower of wine grapes. So if you've ever driven down south of Elk Grove, you'll see miles and miles of vineyards, and most of that goes to Lodi or Stockton or Modesto, where it's turned into wine and becomes one of California's largest exports. And rice is also huge for the region. So the Sacramento Valley right here is famous for its Calrose medium grain sushi rice. If you've ever eaten sushi in a restaurant anywhere in the United States, the odds are really good that that rice was grown right here, and that's also exported. And so Asian countries are a huge buyer of California agricultural commodities. The European Union is our single largest trading partner, followed by Canada. But after that is China, South Korea, and Japan. And if you add the exports from all of those countries together, they make up a huge block of our exports.
So given all of that, what sparked your reporting? What were you seeing or hearing that led you to explore more?
Yeah, agriculture is a huge, of course, passion project for me. And there's been so much kind of talk about logistics and the supply chain. Most of it was around imports. And so that really kind of got me thinking of this shining a spotlight on this lesser concept of exports, which California is a powerhouse for agriculture exports. Of course, we feed the world, and that's often, I think, goes unnoticed when we talk about the global supply chain.
Yeah, I think it's really surprising. We've talked about food insecurity in the past, and it can be so surprising just given all that you have laid out that we grow here in our backyard. What did you learn about food insecurity during the pandemic, specifically our region?
During the pandemic, of course, food insecurity skyrocketed. Even though we were still producing the same amount of food, even increased amounts of food, actually, in 2020, people lost their jobs. The economy basically fell into chaos. Families here weren't able to access that same source of food as they were before. There was a massive influx of people turning to food banks. And then plus the supply chain issues. Of course, we all saw the empty store shelves during the pandemic, and I know we're all still dealing with it. We've all probably experienced that frustration of something that we want to buy that we can't seem to find anywhere anymore. So those things also impacted the food supply, because even though we produce so much food here, most of the food that we eat is from somewhere else and came here on trucks and ships. And when that's disrupted, of course, it's all disrupted.
I've always wondered that. Why do we outsource food when we have a healthy amount of agriculture supply in our backyard? What are the issues that make it challenging to kind of take advantage of the proximity of what's grown here?
Yeah, so there are several things. Over the course of my reporting on this, I've kind of noticed that some of the reasons are because these supply chains have just become entrenched. kind of business as usual of importing products from elsewhere. And it really takes some kind of big disruption for a global pandemic, for example, to shake some things loose. There's a couple big reasons why there's local farmers have trouble accessing local markets. Farmers here face worsening competition from imports, a lot of the time from Mexico or South America, and they just can't compete on the price of those imports. Local farmers, they tend to be a little bit smaller here in the Sacramento region, can't deliver the volume or the year-round supply that big buyers are used to. If you want, you know, fresh table grapes in February, for example, you're probably going to have to get them from somewhere else.
Yeah. What surprised you when you were learning all of this?
I think just the massive amount of food insecurity, even while kind of imports, we have so much food here because of the kind of the breakdown of supply chain crisis. We haven't been able to export as much as we have, as much as we are typically able to. And so there's supply building up here and there's demand here. And still, it's just really a question of logistics of why we're not able to make that work.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about the local food system around us, I mean, can you help us visualize what exactly that is? And also, how do other factors such as, you know, we're a state that has become comfortable with drought? I mean, there's climate change as well as development, employment issues. How does that further strain this local food system?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk about the food system, we talk about it's a huge network of businesses, of nonprofits, of farmers, of cooks, of it includes everything that makes growing food, eating it, and disposing of the waste possible. So farmers, truck drivers is huge, distribution, processors, distributors, buyers, grocery stores, restaurants, you and me, everyone who eats food every day. So, of course, any kind of impact, any kind of disruption in any part of that chain is going to have ripple effects throughout the whole system. So, you know, farmers who this year, because of the drought, maybe they can't plant part of their land. Maybe this year there's going to be a shortage and that's going to ripple its way up the chain. And the next year that farmer's going to have less money to put back into planting and labor issues, of course, has been a challenge in agriculture for years now. And of course, the pandemic has only made it worse on every industry. As those expenses rise at every level of that chain, things get more expensive and more difficult.
You know, we also have a lot of development happening. I mean, does home and retail development, does that have an impact on the food system and really the sale of farmland?
Yeah, so there is a little bit of the sale of farmland happening. Typically, California, the biggest issue is that farmland in California has always been very, very expensive. As the land in general becomes more expensive, of course, that just raises the cost. And while there are a lot of state incentives to keep farmland producing agricultural products, the higher, basically the greater the value of that land and the greater the value of developing it becomes more and more of a values proposition around selling it for development or leaving it in agriculture.
What did you learn about solutions? Your reporting included a survey from Valley Vision and the Sacramento Region Community Foundation. And what was so interesting in learning about the problems and the issues is that there's also an action plan that's attached to these issues to make our region's food system stronger, more equitable, and more sustainable. So what is on this roadmap?
Yeah, so this roadmap was basically an update on a 2015 study that they did, laid the groundwork for strengthening the local food system. And basically the thinking there was, you know, we have all these assets in the Sacramento region. Right. We have UC Davis doing world-renowned crop and food research. We have the best soil and some of the best climate for growing fruits and vegetables of anywhere in the world. We have all these local farmers. We're getting increasing attention for these amazing restaurants. And basically the question that they kind of tried to lay out was, how do we tie all those things in together into what, you know, in business reporting speak, we call an industry cluster? Basically, how do we create an economic sector around food and agriculture that really benefits everyone here in Sacramento? And they laid out, a couple of very specific recommendations from increasing marketing opportunities for local farmers, building some specific infrastructure. Surprisingly, increasing CalFresh enrollment was one of the things that surprised me. It doesn't necessarily seem related to the food system, but they found that only a fraction of people who are eligible for food stamps or CalFresh are on the program, and increasing the number of people who are taking advantage of those programs means just a ripple effect, kind of a multiplier effect on the number of federal dollars that are coming into our local economy to be spent on food. And that has a ripple effect that goes back to farmers, that goes back to producers, that goes back to everyone. And workforce is also a huge issue. Our farmers are aging. There fewer and fewer younger people are getting into the industry. And so they made some specific recommendations around specifically attracting people to agriculture, getting them trained, getting them upskilled for the jobs of the future in agriculture, not just currently, but of the technology of tomorrow is another huge, problem that the region has to solve.
Yeah. What success stories did you come across?
Yeah. So part of the infrastructure recommendations have been around the development of food hubs, which Valley Vision, which did the study, has been advocating for a long, long time. So food hubs are basically designed to tackle a lot of the issues we've been talking about. And there are some very, there's lately been some really good momentum on that. So locally, we got some local money recently from ARPA funds for a YOLO food hub, which is in the works. And then also during the pandemic, there was a Spork food hub, which a couple of farmers in West Sacramento started. They've built this kind of really robust supply chain of growing lettuce and greens and giving it to or selling it to local schools. And so during the pandemic, they were able to gather a bunch of other farmers. And they've also started basically selling greens, fresh vegetables to school cafeterias kind of en masse. And so that's how they're able to kind of meet those volume demands that they weren't able to before. So they were able to do that actually from a grant through the California Department of Food and Agriculture, which I guess wouldn't have been available kind of in years prior.
Well, I guess what I'm hearing is creating a really strong network here so we're not impacted by outside forces that are taking place, you know, across the country or even across the world, since we depend on other countries for our economy, our agriculture economy.
Yeah, I mean, that is the kind of the thinking that if we are, you know, reliant on just ourselves for growing food, then we're not going to be as vulnerable to these kind of supply chain disruptions. And also, I mean, we create, you know, good local jobs, good local businesses, and we continue kind of being the spotlight of the world for agriculture and feeding ourselves.
You know, what was also really interesting is you actually were able to quantify food insecurity across four counties in our region. I believe it's Placer, El Dorado, Sacramento, and Yolo County. I mean, how many people are we talking about?
These numbers are a little bit old, but I think the last time I checked, it was 600,000 people in our region are now kind of on food stamps or seeking some kind of support, food help from food banks, basically food insecure, which means they don't really know where their next meal is coming from. That has, of course, like skyrocketed during the pandemic.
Were you left feeling encouraged following, you know, meeting all these different organizations and community groups that are getting together to help solve this problem?
Of course, a lot of these issues are things that I've been covering for a couple years now, and things that people have been talking about for years, and people, you know, for me have been talking about for decades. And there hasn't been a ton of movement on some of these issues that we know we've needed. There is some signs that there is renewed momentum on these issues. There is, you know, of course, an increase in money coming in from the state and federal governments to kind of solve some of these issues. There does seem to be renewed, I guess, energy towards solving some of these issues. So that is hopeful, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. And there still are challenges. And given that agriculture is one of your beats for the Sacramento Business Journal, do you have an update on a pretty big issue that we've been experiencing lately in the last several months, supply chain issues? I mean, we all know about the ships that are just stuck off the coast of California. What impact has that backlog had on California products like almonds?
Kind of like I mentioned, that there has been a ton of kind of attention on the difficulty that we have had getting stuff from overseas here into California. Just as much or even worse has been the pressure on getting these agricultural exports out of California to our big buyers in Asia. The value of shipping this way, shipping from Asia into California, became so valuable that a lot of the big shipping companies stopped taking local agricultural exports. They didn't want to kind of take the time. They weren't getting the value from shipping those back from California overseas. And so that has created kind of a massive disruption in the industry. In all these industries, our biggest exporters, you know, wine, grapes, almonds, tomatoes. And a lot of the supply chain issues have worked themselves out, but for agriculture, for export specifically, this is still definitely something that our exporters are dealing with. They're dealing with increased costs. They're dealing with, just canceled contracts altogether. They have buyers, they have clients in these countries in Asia, but they're just not able to get the product to them. And that has caused tremendous problems for the past 2 years.
Yeah, that's definitely apparent. Finally, before we let you go, Emily, I mean, another challenge that's facing farmers, I mean, we're kind of entering another year that will involve drought. What are you hearing from farmers in terms of the challenges that you're going to be staying abreast on and following throughout the year?
Yeah, so as we face kind of the past several years, I've been reporting on drought. I've heard growers say, I think this year will be okay, but we'll see if this lasts into next year. We might be in trouble. And so they've been saying that for 3 years now. And we'll basically see. I think last year we saw rice farmers, of course, they fallowed a fifth of their growing of their land. So we're kind of a shortage of our rice farmers in the Sacramento Valley. This year, that could be even worse. Because water is just so expensive and so hard to come by. I think the Northern California Water Agency estimates that more than a billion acres of land in Sacramento Valley will go fallow this year because farmers just don't have enough water to grow anything.
Yeah. Emily, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your reporting.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Emily Hammond is a staff writer for the Sacramento Business Journal. Up next, we'll learn how a string of deadly shootings in Sacramento is fueling a renewed push from community groups for more investment and funding for Sacramento youth. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In the wake of a series of deadly shootings in Sacramento, the calls for more and sustained funding for youth programs has been reinvigorated. Community organizations are coming together to push for more long-term investment, to ease tensions and address some of the root causes of violence, and ultimately prevent more tragedies. To tell us more about this renewed push and the challenges which lay ahead is CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
So we're a little over 2 weeks since the deadly mass shooting in downtown Sacramento, and the hard reality is that acts of gun violence continued in the days that followed throughout the city and even the county. What are you hearing from community groups that you've built relationships with?
Sure. So many of the organizations who I spoke with who work directly with some of Sacramento's underserved communities have renewed their calls for better funding models since the K Street shooting. For reference, the city spent $38 million on youth funding in this past fiscal year. That money went to youth programs, grants for community-based organizations that work on violence and gang prevention, and youth employment. Millions also went to funding community centers, city pools, including the North Natomas Aquatics Complex and the Sacramento Zoo. But for the community organizations that we've been talking to, who have been most involved in the things like youth services and violence prevention, their funding largely comes from grants, which come through the Office of Violence Prevention. Overall, this fiscal year, the city gave out less than $6 million in grants to about a dozen of those organizations and the Sacramento County Office of Education. So that really gives you kind of a scope of just how difficult it can often be for these organizations to secure that funding year to year.
When you talk about the $38 million on youth funding, is the $6 million that went from or came from the Office of Violence Prevention, is that in addition or is that $6 million of the $38 million?
I believe that's $6 million of the $38 million.
Got
my apologies.
So it's just a fraction. Who are the organizations that receive these grants and how do they use the funding for at-risk youth in Sacramento?
There are a number of organizations working to prevent youth violence in underserved communities. So these include a Black Child Legacy Campaign and a program they run called Healing the Hood, along with Movement for Life, which works with young people at risk for joining gangs and getting involved in gang-related violence. Healing the Hood, which is with the Sierra Health Foundation, has been working to provide mental health services, counseling, and job training opportunities to young people in underserved neighborhoods in Sacramento. And both these organizations mentioned just how important programming like life skills training, job training, and addressing problems in a holistic way were. But they also mentioned that funding continues to be mostly grant-based, as we just heard, which means the work is not always guaranteed to continue past a grant cycle. All organizations mentioned that prior to the pandemic, Sacramento had had 2 years without a single youth homicide. That's a record for the city. And they attributed this drop in violence to their programming, to their programs really making an impact.
Yeah, I remember that. We had the Black Child Legacy campaign on Insight earlier this month on this very topic. And you spoke with Kim Williams, who directs Healing the Hood, and you talked about how the pandemic affected at-risk youth and communities in Sacramento. What stood out to you most from that conversation?
Yeah, so I think the most remarkable thing that Williams mentioned to me was that, like I said, Sacramento had prior to the pandemic been experiencing a time of relative calm in terms of youth violence, which just really points to evidence that a lot of their work and a lot of the work that these organizations were doing was working. But she also mentioned that she had started to see signs of tension and unrest even before the K Street shooting. Here she is.
The increase in violence across this country since the pandemic has been overwhelming, and Sacramento is not unique. We are experiencing that as well. Our crisis response folks, which we call community intervention workers, they're getting calls to go out, you know, daily now, whereas we had a period of a year, 2 years where we didn't have any youth homicides in Sacramento City. You know, we're now responding to them weekly. And so, you know, folks have been impacted by the pandemic. The pandemic has magnified issues that have been in our communities for a long time.
Yeah, that is a 180 in the worst possible direction. I mean, when you spoke with Movement for Life, that's the other organization that you previously brought up. That nonprofit helps at-risk youth. I mean, what did you learn from them?
Yeah, so I spoke with Julius Thibodeau. He is the director of the organization. And this organization actually has existed. I mean, they may sound new to some folks who have been in the space, but they are actually a continuation of a larger group that's based out of the Bay Area called Advanced Peace. They've kind of morphed into this local version, which is called Movement for Life, just for folks who are curious. But essentially, Advanced Peace and the Advanced Peace model has been de-escalating and preventing youth gang violence before it happens. So for Julius, this means that he's been working to make individual contact with young people. It determines who are at risk for being involved in gang violence and de-escalating that behavior with counseling and specific trips outside of their immediate neighborhoods, sometimes actually with rival gang members or with other groups that they're having trouble with. But he also said that because of the pandemic, a lot of their in-person programming had to stop, and that really set them back.
A lot of the things that we had that made the program so successful, a lot of the strategy itself, we weren't able to employ. There was no life skills classes were discontinued. All the community centers where we held the life skills classes, they were closed, the parks. So many of the things, and of course the excursions, we weren't able to get young people out of the environment where they are experiencing the most trauma.
And that continues to have ripple effects. I mean, life may feel like it's returning more to normal than it has been, but the pandemic is still creating obstacles, I would imagine, for these community groups working to provide opportunities for children living in Sacramento's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, absolutely. You're totally right, Vicky. All of these groups mentioned that some of their biggest challenges have just been getting back to in-person programming. Julius mentioned that many of the spaces they used to conduct their work in, so parks, community centers, and religious institutions like churches, mosques, and temples, they all ended up getting closed in the early part of the pandemic, and this made gathering much harder for them. I think that for these organizations, something like steadier funding would allow for these programs to continue independently of these buildings happening, since they were essentially taking place inside of other community centers and are dependent on other community centers. Here's Julius Thibodeau of Movement for Life again.
The same way you have the fire department, just in case there's a fire. Community-based organizations, they need to be mainstays, they need to be pillars, and they need to be invested in long-term.
Yeah, not just grants, but sustainable funding. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan about how a string of deadly shootings is fueling a renewed push for more funding for Sacramento youth. That brings me to the city. Is the city listening to these concerns that really have just been heightened following a mass shooting in downtown Sacramento a little over 2 weeks ago? What are they saying in response?
So city officials have told us that they are listening and hearing this criticism. In a conversation with Councilmember Jay Schneer and Mayor Daryl Steinberg last week, both agreed that the city needs a more consistent way to fund its youth services programs. As I mentioned earlier, most of the organizations doing the bulk of this violence prevention work got just around $6 million from the city this past year, which is a relatively small amount of the pie. Mayor Steinberg spoke with us and talked in particular about looking at youth services not just as a one and done event, but as something that follows a person throughout their life.
Especially when it comes to gang intervention, there's no one strategy that is going to stem the violence. And so it is a continuum. And I think as we write this and as we final this with the community, that there needs to be room for investments along all parts of the spectrum, with an even greater focus, though, on going upstream, because it's that elementary school kid, it's that middle school kid. We've got to envelop those young people with as much support as we can offer in this community.
And there has been proposals in the past. Recently in 2020, there was a ballot measure, Measure G, which was ultimately rejected by voters, but it would have directed Sacramento to spend a percentage of money from the city's general fund for youth programs. Is there any discussion about renewing this measure or even similar measures?
Absolutely. So Councilmember Deschenier is currently working on putting forward a proposal to rework the language of Measure G by looking at the way youth violence prevention services are defined. So in October 2020, the City Council expanded their definition of public safety to include youth-centered prevention services like the work that Black Child Legacy Campaign and Movement for Life do. Deschenier's resolution is proposing that there be a way for the council to increase its investment in these youth programs by the same percentage as any budget increase that is given to the police, fire, and emergency services department. So kind of giving it that sense of parity and saying that these two departments are equal in terms of importance.
So we passed this resolution a while ago, redefining public safety to include prevention services for young people. And this is really a step towards implementation of that. So as we think about public safety, my hope is that people think about prevention as much as we think about other things. So, you know, there's a parity issue around potential increases in funding.
Yeah, prevention in addition to response, you know, and yes. The city is just one piece of this. Mayor Steinberg has also called on Governor Gavin Newsom to spend $3 billion on crime prevention. What were reactions from community members and advocates that you spoke with regarding this potential state funding?
Advocates absolutely believe that there needs to be more funding put into things like youth services to prevent violence. I don't know if any of them were particularly aware about this $3 billion call that Mayor Steinberg has put out, but I think that they absolutely feel that there is a need for more funding and more resources wherever it's coming from. Here's Kim Williams of Healing the Hood again.
But we also know that in order to try to prevent crises, we have to get young people and we have to get them as young as we can to make sure that we can, we can stop. We're not just trying to stop the bleeding. We've got to actually go to where the wound is and we've got to close it there. And so it's a both and that becomes a challenge when you don't have the resources.
So right now, Shanira's resolution, I would say, is what seems the most promising. It's currently going through the Law and Legislative Committee, and I believe it is set to go before City Council in the next coming weeks. But of course, a few things to note on that. As of right now, his resolution does not include details on where this extra funding would come from at this point. And these funds would not include the city's Office of Violence Prevention, though there is an agreement that this office also needs more funding. This funding could absolutely be coming from the state if that does end up happening. And of course, it is going to be a couple weeks, which is not a whole lot of time, but still a couple weeks before we actually see City Council take any action on this.
Yeah, I mean, there's still so much to hash out. And Sarah, obviously, you're a race and equity reporter, so you've been building these relationships and having these conversations, you know, since you got here to CAP Radio. What struck you or what are you left with after the conversations that you had in your most recent report?
You know, I think that it feels like a confluence of a lot of different factors that really came together and resulted in what we saw as the K Street shooting or what we are just seeing in general in the community as a greater amount of violence happening. I know that, you know, Movement for Life mentioned that it isn't just shootings that are happening at a greater frequency now. It's carjackings, it's armed robberies, you know, it's petty crimes like that. And they said that they felt that all of these things are related in a continuum. I think that, you know, we're just seeing a continuum of communities of color, underserved communities in Sacramento, just continuing to struggle. And that struggle will manifest oftentimes. I mean, this is a great example of just how all of our struggles are kind of wrapped into one here, because sometimes that struggle will manifest in violence and that violence impacts all of us as Sacramentans.
Yeah, we're all connected. Sarah, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Vicki.
And that is CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan sharing her reporting on how a string of deadly shootings and gun violence is fueling a renewed push for more funding for Sacramento youth. Still ahead, we meet the co-founders of a free website that streamlines, filters, and sorts hundreds of summer camps. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Thank you. Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There are hundreds upon hundreds of summer camps in the six-county Sacramento region alone. Searching for the right camp that fits the interest, price, age group, location, dates, it can be a lift. So much so, two Sacramento parents took it upon themselves to streamline the process. They co-founded a website that aggregates and filters summer camps across the Sacramento region, and that service is free of charge. Those parents are Megan Phillips and DJ Waldo, and their website is called Simple Summers. Megan, DJ, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicky, for having us. It's awesome to be able to share Simple Summers with a lot of the community this morning.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be excited to learn about this. I'm just curious, DJ, I want to start with you. How did this come about?
Well, it started about 4 years ago. Megan is a neighbor of mine, literally lives four houses down from me. Our kids are friends with each other, and we were looking for summer camps that our two oldest kids could go to together. And it was stressful. It was really hard to not only find the right camp, but then to align our schedules so that her daughter and my daughter could go to the same camp. And they're a little bit of different ages, so that made it even harder. So, you know, we started the process by just looking at Google and searching for summer cooking camps. And it was hard. There wasn't a lot of options, and there was nothing that aggregated all of the camps together. And we literally were both tech savvy enough that we grabbed some Google Sheets and shared and tried to put our schedules together. And we just could not find an easy way to do it. And we thought, wow, if this is hard for us, I can imagine how difficult it is for other parents. We sort of looked around and thought, does this exist anywhere, any kind of aggregator for camps, an easy way to search and sort and filter? And there wasn't. So Megan and I decided that we would move our relationship from neighbors to business partners.
I imagine the conversations the two of you had, a lot of parents and families can relate to. So Megan, for those of us who aren't parents or haven't gone the summer camp route just yet, what were the main challenges and frustrations that you and DJ were talking about that really ultimately led to creating a website?
I think first and foremost was the hunt and peck model that was being used on Google. There wasn't a place to truly explore by interest or budget. You could find something that was fabulous and then realize it just didn't match what your budget was or the weeks that you really needed support because you had a busy work schedule. So first and foremost, we just knew that the hunting and pecking was not bringing the results that every parent could utilize in a much more efficient fashion. And then what truly also revealed itself to us was that, you know, not only were we serving caregivers, but we were also serving camps. And that was sort of a secondary bonus to this, was that camps work really hard to give incredible material and curriculum during summer. And that's their focus, from amazing language camps that are out there to gardening camps. Like, they are strong in what they do and they are not marketers. And I really hope that, you know, not only were we helping caregivers find ways to easily find and sort camps for their needs, but also for camps to get marketed and be able to share some of the incredible services that they offer to our community. And then last but not least, we know that summer camps are a privilege. We know that there is a lot of cost to making sure kids are, you know, continuing curriculum through the summer. But as we all know, as we just heard, youth programs, the need for what has happened the past 2 years during the pandemic, the loss of school is even more critical. So we just really wanted to make sure that there was just a big opportunity for people to find and explore things to help keep their education and interests top of mind.
And that led to Simple Summers, which is the website. DJ, help us visualize the website. What can people expect when they visit Simple Summers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when they come to Simple Summers, we want to make it really easy to explore and discover camps immediately. So you can immediately go in and start searching for camps. You can look based on, price, type of camp, date, sort of the other things you described earlier on. And then we show about 12 camps to start off. And we have currently, as of today, I think 502. So we show the top 12 to start with an incentive that, hey, we really want you to create an account because then you can customize your search results. So once you create an account, it's very simple, again, to do. We like to use the word simple a lot. And once you create an account, you add your camper and you put their age in there. And once you put their age in, then all of your searches start to go based on age. And so, for example, I have a 12-year-old. So when I put her information in, the 500 camps all of a sudden go down to 300 because she's only eligible for 300. So the reality we found too is parents don't, like, I'm not going to search through 500 camps, but if there's 300 that my kid can go to, that's more interesting. Now, if I start to customize that search by saying, well, she's really interested in theater, for example, then the 300 goes down to 20. And then if I pick a specific date and a specific amount, that 20 goes down to 2 or 3. Now, within a matter of less than a minute, I've honed in on exactly the camp that fits for my budget, my schedule, and my child's interest.
You likened it when we chatted on the phone to like an Airbnb of summer camps. I like that. I like that analogy. It's a good way to visualize it.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is everything's in one spot. I mean, when you go to Airbnb, you're looking, you're doing all the same things we talked about. You're looking for a particular budget and a location and a date. And that's the same thing we're doing. The big difference here is we're looking for what is your child's interest. And here's the other interesting thing, I think, is that if you have more than one child, we have four. So trying to coordinate your schedule with all four of your kids, if you create four camper profiles, you can select all four. Now I can find a camp that I can send all four of my kids to on the same date. So for working parents especially, that's really a game changer because now I don't have to drive to four different areas. I can drop all my kids off at one camp and hopefully pick them up later at 5:30.
Yeah. You know, Megan, what's also so interesting, when you guys launched this in 2019, this is technically the fourth summer of Simple Summers, obviously, through the pandemic, but you also did focus groups. What did you learn from these focus groups?
We learned, first and foremost, that summer camps, there was definitely an economic barrier to finding really the most opportunistic camps for each family. Every single family was different. That was the first thing we realized. What we've also found is, I will tell you, there are so many free and really budget-friendly camps to keep kids active. So that was really exciting to be able to support sort of every single family and what their needs were. Focus groups also felt like they were going to the same exact camps all the time because it was what they knew and they weren't exploring. I'd say the number one thing that we hear and probably in the past year was, I had no idea this camp existed. And that was what is so exciting, is we're opening doors to folks that have, kids who are interested in bouldering or kids who are really interested in coding. There's so many interests that we're able to bring to the forefront that they just didn't know existed. And I think that was really what's been exciting with our focus groups. Most importantly, we have more features that we're continuing to iterate on all of the time. I think the number one thing we continue to hear is one-stop registration. We haven't done that yet, but it definitely rose to the surface for a lot of our caregivers who kept saying, I fill out 5 different forms all the time with the same information. And so that innovation that we want to bring and to streamline things to make it even easier and also to keep your, a lot of things private through one source is something we're really exploring next.
Yeah, that brings me to the demand. What kind of demand have you two seen since debuting Simple Summers, Megan?
I'm going to let DJ take that one, but I'll tell you, after coming out of COVID, we had no idea, and I don't think we're out of COVID. I just want to say that after, you know, after quarantine and after the summer of 2020, last year, we saw a tremendous, tremendous amount of traffic because there was such a need. And we're able to really look at even communities that are searching. But DJ, I'll kind of let you share a little bit about that demand.
Yeah, and DJ, also talk about the most popular summer camp searches. I think that's a fun one.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. So, yeah, I would say, I mean, like Megan said, it was interesting because we thought our searches would sort of go down over the last, you know, 2020 and 2021, because 2020, there really weren't that many camps. Some were trying to do virtual. Our traffic remained pretty steady, if not increasing. So parents were and caregivers were definitely looking to find those camps. And we added all of the virtual camps that we could find. And we did the same thing last year. There's still a few of those that exist on the site today. But I would say our traffic, I mean, it continues to go up. I think parents are starting to find that, you know, I think of like, there's sort of a few groups of parents. There's the 10 to 15% that start looking for camps in January or February. Then there's the, you know, maybe 15 or 20% that start looking in April or May. And then there's the most of us that are looking, you know, oh, my kids are out of school next week. And then they start looking in June. And so we do see definite spikes in traffic. But to answer your other question around what are people looking for, this blew my mind. So we can see data. I mean, that's one of the most powerful things we can give back to camps too, by the way, is we can tell them what are people searching for. And week after week, consistently, the number one search on our site by far is for horseback riding, horse camps.
Wow.
Which I know when we talked yesterday was kind of surprising too. And it's still surprising to me. Those camps fill up very quickly. And I didn't know that was as much of a thing. The other one that's really interesting now, and this won't surprise based on national trends, but we have a pickleball camp on our site. So your kids can learn pickleball and go to a summer camp that's all about pickleball.
Yeah. And in addition to the bouldering that you mentioned earlier on in our conversation, too, I mean, that's a pretty interesting variety. If I had a multiple choice, I probably wouldn't have chosen those three.
Well, and your comment about the bouldering, what's really neat about that one is it's all in how you message it, right? So if we put on, people aren't necessarily searching for bouldering, but they might search for rock climbing or climbing or outdoor. And then that's where we're able to help camps as well, because those results appear for climbing. And we've actually had several people that have said, I didn't even know what bouldering was. Now I'm going to, you know, the Boulder Field or other camps like that. And this is amazing. So it's opening doors to new experiences for children and their families as well.
This just sounds like it's just the beginning. You know, it's really scalable to expand. You know, Megan, you know, given that it's a free service for families, you know, how do you find, you know, just the funding for this website to support overhead costs? And what conversations are you and DJ having about continuing to grow Simple Summers?
That's a great question. It's certainly been a labor of love. And we wanted to test and pilot Sacramento with this idea of a one-stop shop for summer camps. And it truly has now, I would say, cracked open to be a huge site that we can absolutely scale. We have friends, every time we post on social media, we have friends and family in different cities who are like, please bring this to Nashville. I need this in San Diego. We're still kind of, you know, doing the same archaic searches for what we can do during the summer. So, you know, this year is a year in which we're going to get our, you know, settle down into a somewhat of a normal year to kind of see what our data is showing with camps and how we can support them. And then we're really looking to put definitely one-stop registration into our process based on those focus groups so that folks can have one form and submit them through camps. And then most importantly, we want to continue to grow this city to city and hopefully help a lot more caregivers out and a lot more camps out in the future. Currently, the only way we're sort of funded is we have some featured camps on our site, which pull up, you know, sort of they're not advertising. We don't want to have an advertising site. We want to have a site in which, you know, there are featured camps, but that right now is all we're doing.
Yeah. So it seems like this is really just kind of the tip of the iceberg. And you already have over 500 camps, 1,500 camp sessions. DJ, I guess any final thoughts before we let you go about what the future holds for Simple Summers?
Yeah, I just want to say a couple more things and building on what Megan said. I mean, Megan has been, you know, just a great friend and a great business partner, obviously. And one of the things I love about her is the focus and the singular focus on let's figure out summer camps in Sacramento first before we do anything else. And, you know, I sort of, if you know me, my mind is always wandering to what we could do next, but she's really helped with that laser focus. And that's important because people have asked us, well, what about winter break camps or what about helping adults? And those are all things that our site can do and has the technology to do, but we want to really figure out Sacramento and summer camps. And I'd say one other thing to wrap up is that, you know, Megan's been a huge advocate since day one of making summer camps accessible for as many children as possible. And so, you know, hopefully once we get funding, we'll have the ability to do the single site registration. And then the idea is to build in scholarships. So let's say you're getting a camp for your kid and it's $300, you can chip in an extra $10 that will help support other children in the community that may not have the resources, you know, the sort of the underserved, underprivileged youth that can then go to these camps.
Megan Phillips and DJ Waldo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky, for
Thanks
having
so much,
us on
Vicky.
This morning.
Megan and DJ are the co-founders of Simple Summers, a website that filters and aggregates hundreds of summer camps across Sacramento's region, and it's free of charge. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Emily Zentner. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's Chief Content Officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.